Okay. So today we want to continue the discussion of last week's on quivers, and we will try to focus a little bit also on the explicit metrics that have been found last year and this year. So before we discuss a little bit, we review the conifold, which is a well-known example. Then we will see how to generalize this discussion for a general Calabi-Yau cone. And we see that we can take three different points of view. One is differential geometry, so with the explicit metric. One is an algebraic description of the singularity. And one is the n equal 1 quiver gauge theories. So then we will write down these explicit metrics, which are not that complicated. And we will see that all these new metrics will have some U1 isometry that enable us to use toric geometry, which is a useful device to discuss these three, the relation between these three points of view. And using toric geometry and a little bit of this new dimer techniques, we will describe mostly the YPQ quivers, which are which correspond to a subset of this new Sasaki-Einstein metric. Then maybe we can discuss a little bit also various checks and various studies that can be done once we know the different aspects of the story. So for the conifold, we have a Calabi-Yau. We take type 2B string theory on R4 times the conifold. So the conifold is a Calabi-Yau threefold, which is given by the following equation. So we take four complex numbers, and we take the manifold given by this equation, xy equals dw. So the first thing we can notice is that in this equation we can rescale by a complex number these four variables, and the equation will still be satisfied. And this means that this complex manifold is a cone, since there is this rescaling symmetry. So what we want to do is to put the D3 brains on the singular point, and there is a singular point here, which is the tip of the cone, which is given by x equal y equal t equal w equal 0. So we want to take this a stack of D3 brains that are coincident, and we put them at the singular tip of this cone. This is the conifold. These are n D3 brains. So the question is, what is the gauge theory that lives on the D3 brains? We know that if we put the D3 brains on C3 instead of the conifold, we get n equal 4 supersymmetric gauge theories. In this case, we know that if we compactify type 2B on a Calabi-Yau, we get n equal 2 supersymmetry in 4 dimension, but if we put the 3 brains, we break half of the supersymmetry, so we get something which is n equal 1. So what can be shown is that on this manifold, which is there is a Calabi-Yau metric. Then we will write it explicitly. So the answer was given by Clebano and Witten, and the gauge theory is SUN cross SUN. So we have two gauge groups. And we take them to be SUN, but we could have taken them to be UN, and then the U1 could play a role. And then there will be some matter fields that there will be chiral multiplets. So we have two different doublets of chiral multiplet. So I and J goes from 1 to 2. And the first doublet will transform in the fundamental of the first gauge group and the antifundamental of the second, and the opposite for the other thing. So there is, as we saw the other time, there is a device to draw this matter content of the theory, which is we draw two dots for every gauge group, and we draw arrows for every bifundamental fields. In this case, we have a double arrow. So let's say this is the first gauge group, this is the second. We have one double arrows going in this direction, which corresponds to the two AI, and one double arrow is going in the opposite direction, which corresponds to the 2BJ. And in order to specify further the theory, we have to say what is the superpotential. The superpotential is only one way of writing down superpotential with respect to the global symmetries of this manifold. Here there is an SU2 cross SU2 acting on this manifold, which has to be present also in the gauge theory side as a global symmetry of the gauge theory. So this AI will transform in the first as a doublet in the first SU2, and the BJ will transform as a doublet of the second SU2. So the superpotential will be something like, will be proportional to AI BJ AK BL, and we put the two epsilon symbols. One for the A's, so epsilon IK, and one for the B's, so epsilon JL. This is the only superpotential which preserves this SU2 cross SU2 global symmetry. So another way to draw this picture, as we saw the other time, is to draw a periodic. Instead of drawing the quiver in this way, we draw it periodically on the plane. So. In this case, we'll get something like this. So let's say this is the first gauge group, and this is the second. Then we draw arrows in this way. And then we take a fundamental domain on this periodic tiling of the plane. But it is important to notice that with respect to last week, this is not the dimer graph. It is a dual graph of the dimer. We have replaced faces with nodes and nodes with faces. So for instance, we can take a fundamental domain in this way. You see that we have two nodes, like as here, and for every node there are two ingoing and two outgoing arrows. And if we take the rule that for every face we have a superpotential term, we see that there are two faces. Sorry, we can. This is one face. And the white one is another phase, and so we have two superpotential terms, and if we expand this superpotential, we see that they exactly match. So this is so here we saw two different points of view. We saw the algebraic geometry description of the conifold, and we saw that we get the gauge theory. One way to check that this is a proposal, this is a generalization of the ADS-CFT or of the original ADS-CFT conjecture. So one way to check the proposal is to compute some quantities on the gauge side and see if we can reproduce the algebraic description. And for instance, the first thing that one can do is to study the X branch of this theory. The X branch is a complex manifold and since this X branch should correspond to moving the ND3 branches, keeping them parallel, we should see that the moduli space is the conifold to the power of n divided by the symmetric group of permutation of n numbers. So if this is the conifold. Okay, so here we see that there is also the U1. In this case, there are two U1s that one would like to add to this SUN. There is one U1 which is decoupled, and this is the plays exactly the same role of the U1 in n equal 4, which is used to have a S duality. And then there is another U1 which is the difference of these two, which becomes a global symmetry, and the other U1s act with charge plus for the AI and with charge minus for the BJ. And this is associated to a baryonic symmetry in the theory, and this is associated to the topology of the real base of this cone. So what is the real base of this cone? We know that there is a Calabi-Yau metric, which is a conical metric. So let's say we have a Calabi-Yau threefold, which is a six-dimensional real manifold. So this, since we impose it to be a cone, this the metric will be something like this.
Sorry, I missed something. What was this conical to the end? That's
So this is the Calabi-Yau cone.
Yes.
And the moduli space of Aqua of the theory of the X branch of the conformal field theory will be in this form. So we expect this to be true because we expect the X branch to correspond to moving the brains of the on the cone. So we have the brains will be point-like on the conifold. So we expect something like that because we have n brains. And we can do, this is an expectation, but one can do the computation using the superpotential, and one finds exactly this result. Okay, now we want to describe the metric on this. Up to here, we have an algebraic description and the gauge theory, which can be thought of as a more detailed algebraic description of the singularity. So since we have a cone, the metric will be something like this, where this five-dimensional metric will not depend on R. So R is a coordinate that goes from 0 to infinity. And so we have an R plus action, which are the rescaling of these coordinates R. And this tells us that this is a cone. So definition, the fact that this is Ricci flat implies that this metric is Einstein. So we have R mu nu. So this is a five-dimensional compact manifold that has to satisfy this equation. So this 4 is not important. It's because here we didn't put any number. We put 1. If we also want that this is a Keller manifold, then this will be Sasaki. This, if we want, is a definition of Sasaki-Einstein metric. So for the conifold, we can write down explicitly the five-dimensional metric. The space for the conifold is called T11, which this is why. So this is a five-dimensional metric. We have now, this is the metric on, everybody recognize this is the metric on around S2, and now I've written down the metric for the other, for another one, parametrized by theta, this parametrized by theta 1, phi 1, and now there is one parametrized by theta 2 and phi 2. So the five coordinates, we have one psi coordinates, and we have theta 1, phi 1, and theta 2, phi 2. Here we have these two metric for the round S2. And here we have this psi is a U1 fiber. We see that no, there is no function depending on psi. So this is an isometry we have. And this isometry, so here we see that we have a U1 fibration over the base. This base is S2 times S2. And this isometry in the gauge theory corresponds to the U1R global symmetry, which is a supersymmetric pattern of the scaling symmetry. And in the geometry, we can see that if imposed that it is we have a Calabi-Yau, that it is a cone, so we have this rescaling symmetry, and as a partner, we have this psi shift. And this is a general thing. In general, what one can say is that a five-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein metric can be written in this way. So we have the psi plus sigma square plus ds4 square, where sigma is a one form on the four-dimensional base, and there is no dependence of psi anywhere. So this is a general thing. If we start with the Calabi-Yau cone, we can reduce to be a five-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein metric, and then we can do a further reduction this is not very this is not really general, but at least locally we can do something like that. We can isolate a U1 coordinates. This will be the indicator.
Every Sasaki Einstein fivefold is U1
five. No. No. Locally.
What's this from?
That was believed until about 2 years ago.
Mm. Okay, so what are you writing?
So this is a local. You can always write the local form of the metric in this way. This is a general thing, and this four-dimensional will be a cut.
So in other words, d psi plus sigma is not equal.
There's
an
infinitesimal.
No. In general, will be an R. So if this is a U1 R action, then it will be an R action.
So what happened? People construct. I mean, differential geometers had sort of speculated that the U1 action was always quasi-regular. And there were real puzzles about, so there were abstract existence theorems for the existence of a Sasaki-Einstein metric on a U1 bundle over a Del Pezzo surface when the Del Pezzo was a DP 3 or greater, but not 1 or 2.
Yes.
Right? And yet DP 0 has a metric. I mean, it was totally mysterious why there should be this funny gap. And it was because various people who had studied this thing believed that the U1 action was the way. It was only when, only the first of the real example,
so in general, if it is regular, you can quotient and you get a smooth Keller-Einstein manifold. And there are 6 examples of this, something like that. If it is quasi-regular, you can take the quotient and you will have a Keller-Einstein with orbifold singularities. If it's not, if it is irregular, which is in a sense is the generic case, and this and the most almost every one of the new metrics are lying in a quasi in the irregular class, then you don't have a U1 action. This is just an isometry, but it's only the infinitesimal, as you. So only locally you can do that.
What does it mean by crazy regular? So what's
the regular means that you have a new one action which is free, so you can take the quotient and you will have a smooth Keller-Einstein base. And there are the example are CP2, P1 cross P1, and Del Pezzo. N with n going from 3 to 8. These are the regular. These are the Keller-Einstein, the smooth Keller-Einstein base. Every time you have a regular, you can take the quotient and you will get a smooth Keller-Einstein. This is Keller.
And by the way, there's a proof that there is no regular metric in the case of P1. Not a lack of.
These are all, you know that there are metrics here. You know explicitly the metric here. You don't know the metric explicitly, but you know that there are some metrics, and you know that these are all. There is a classification of Tian and Diao that tells you that here you really get a Keller-Einstein metric. Then you can have a quasi-regular. For instance, you can take orbifold. Let's take if you take a U1 fiber over here, you get an S5. You can take a lot of orbifolds of S5. And this will fall in the quasi-regular class. It means that if you do the quotient, you will find singularities, orbifold singularity on the four-dimensional base. But the most general case, which is in a sense the generic one, you cannot take the quotient.
You want actually for free. It's equivalent.
Okay. So this. Okay. So, but in any case, this is a thing you can always do locally. At least locally, you can write the metric in this way. Okay. So, So here you use in the generic case we use all the symmetry we have. We start from the cone, so we use the fact that there is this rescaling symmetry, and we want also Calabi-Yau, so we have a supersymmetry, and we use this new symmetry. So in general, the program one would like to do is to take these three different point of view. So from one side, one has an algebraic description of the singularity. For instance, in this case, we have an equation, something like that. And another point of view is a differential description. And in the other side, we have a gauge theories. We have a and we know that there will always be quiver gauge theories. So in general, one is interested to study this. So from the gauge theory, it's pretty easy to get the algebraic description. If one has one gauge theory, one has to compute the moduli space of vacuum of the theory. If one has the differential description, one has more information with respect to just algebraic. But doing this process is, I don't think this is there is any way of going up in this way. Doing the opposite direction here, it's not very simple in general. There are some algebraic geometric techniques that maybe Chris is going to discuss on Thursday, which are called exceptional collection. But here we don't want to use heavy algebraic geometry. And instead, okay, if the other direction in this way is not should be simple because here one has much more information with respect to here. So what this is the generic problem. We want to study this problem. Starting from the fact that we know some new explicit Sasaki-Einstein metric. So here we have an example of Sasaki-Einstein metric.
To complete this diagram, what would you say about the relation between quivers and differential description?
Okay, it's not. We don't have a way of going. One way could be using some spin chain here, taking the coherent state effective action for the spin chain. So one would find a two-dimensional sigma model with target space, which is more or less this Keller-Einstein base. But it's not clear how to construct the spin chain for the strong interacting gauge theory. So I wouldn't say we have the... This is one way. Maybe there are other ways, but it's not... In general, it's not obvious.
I mean, if you could compute a two-point function in the gauge theory, then in principle, you get a metric on the moduli space of vacuum.
Of what operator?
Scalar fields. Yeah, you compute two-point functions for the scalar fields.
Whether it's exactly the right one or simply.
Yeah, you need to do it for gauge invariant operators to get the gauge invariant answer. It's not clear what are the right coordinates.
So I understood that some of the recent constructions, maybe the LPQRs, actually used some of the quiver theory understanding of the metrics to help make the construction. Are you going to talk about that, or is that not part of this?
Well, actually, they use. You don't really use all the metric. No, we don't have a PQR. Use some information, but not. You can reconstruct, for instance, for the gauge theory, you can reconstruct this sigma, this one chord, this one form. This is something you can do, but you cannot, at least up to now, you cannot reconstruct this, which is much more difficult.
But one possible meaning to your question is maybe you mean the knowledge that the metrics had SU2 as orbital was helpful in the way of which the piece of paper.
I mean, to be honest, I've only read the introductions of the papers that compare the metrics, and I just remember some remark in an introduction about how, or maybe it was a talk I heard that I thought I heard somebody say, but I can't remember it. So I'll withdraw the question.
The construction's in.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, so this is one example, and another example is if you take S5, which is a U1 vibration over CP2, and these examples are. Homogeneous manifold, meaning that there is an isometry that starting from any point takes you to any other point. And these were the only two examples. And these are the only two homogeneous Sasaki-Einstein manifolds. So the other example, which would have been more difficult. And last year, we have Jerome Gauntlet and the others found the generalization of the conifold metric, if you want. And these are called the YPQ spaces. And then this year, this YPQ were generalized to LPQR, where we have a more general set of examples. So I write down the metric.
Supersymmetry.
The supersymmetry is always the same. You just reduce the global symmetry.
Okay.
So it's always n equal one super conformal field theorem.
Yes.
Like for the conifold, it's n equal one, and all these examples are the same supersymmetry, but you have less global symmetry. So this is good if one wants to do some check. In the sense, having less global symmetry maybe enables you to do some more dynamical checks of the ADS-CFT correspondence. So let's write the metric. It's written in the same way. We have the general metric is can be written for I'll write down the LPQR and then we discuss the. It can always be written in this way. So we have to write what is sigma. We take as a coordinates, we take x, phi x, y, phi y. Okay, let's see. Y, I'm sorry. So we have sigma is alpha minus x, 1 minus y over alpha d phi plus beta minus x, 1 plus y over 2 beta d psi. This is the U1 vibration, and
this sigma gives you the color form on the base.
Yes, if you take the derivative of sigma, you get 2 times the symplectic form on the base. In this case, you get always something like the x, the phi, the y, the phi, or then you never get the phi, the psi. Then we see why. Okay, this four-dimensional, so this is locally Keller-Einstein metric, is something like this. So here we put 1, 4. Then we have f of x divided. So this is the first line, which more or less is intended to resemble this line. And the second line is pretty similar, but with for the y coordinates. Then I'll say what is rho square f and g. Okay, so this rho square is just a linear function of x and y, and f is a cubic function of only x, and g is a cubic function of only y. So this is a... So rho square is 1/2 alpha plus beta.
This psi is not like that psi up there.
Ah, sorry.
More like phi 2.
Yes, this is psi, let's call it another. Or psi r. And then we have f of x is a cubic function that depends. It's a cubic function of x that depends on alpha, beta, and another parameter. And then g of y is another cubic function. So the point is that if you do this, if you compute the Ricci tensor here, you find something which is proportional with a factor of 6 to the metric. So this is an Einstein metric in 4 dimension. And then one can see that it is scalar, and then one can see that this is the derivative of this one form gives the Keller form on the 4-dimensional base. And more or less one can see that if this the two coordinates of the cubic function here, so here we have three, since the cubic function we have three zeros. something like that. When if you move the parameter in such a way that one zero, two zeros collides, and so we get something like this. Then we are back in an example like this one. So here we can rewrite the metric. If we redefine cos theta, we call cos theta 1, we call it x. We have here we have x.
You're saying that is T11
if T11 is one example.
Have a double root like that?
Yes. So T11 it's when both here we have three roots and here we have three roots. If we play with the parameter in such a way, real, yes, they are real because if we play with the parameter in such a way that two of these three roots collide here and two here collides as well, then we get back to T11. If two of the roots collides only, for instance for x, then we go for a special case where we have YPQ.
What happens if you have one root?
It's always three because of the range of the parameter you take in consideration.
Okay, but I guess you didn't tell us much about this cubic, but you're just going to plug that into some differential equations and say it's Gödel-Einstein. How could that tell how could that know about whether f has three?
There's a global issue that hasn't been written down.
Yeah, this is only the local thing.
All right.
So locally we have two continuous parameters. We can play with these metrics, and you can take them to be alpha and beta. So for instance, if you take alpha equal beta, then one of these two roots collide here, I think, and we go back to the YPQ where we have the asymmetry is enhanced. So let's see a little bit. Here we have three U1 isometries. One can see. So
you wrote f of x equals, but you can.
Okay, I can write. So here we see that if alpha is equal beta, then this become a quadratic function, and we go back to something like if we redefine here cos theta 1 to be x, this matrix become dx over 1 minus x squared, and here we have 1 minus x squared.
Alpha equals beta still leaves a parameter.
There's
no parameter over there.
Yes, here we have two parameters.
Actually, you have three.
Yes, but this mu you can if you redefine, if you rescale x, y, alpha, beta, you can put mu to be one, mu to be one, zero. But it's better. Typically, you can keep this mu. So if you take alpha equal beta, we see that this y dependence here goes away. This becomes just quadratic. So we have exactly this structure. And this is when the YPQ, so this is around S2. And so for alpha equal beta, we go back to the YPQ. And for if we take a particular value of this alpha equal beta, also here, we have a collision of two roots, and we go back to the conifold. So let's see how this. So this can be more or less seen as a deformation of the conifold. Let's see what is the reason. Another way of seeing this thing. So we have three U1 isometry. One isometry shifts psi. One isometry shifts psi, and then we have the U1R isometry that shifts eta. And instead the.
Say what the
normal
molecules are too, to get a solution?
Well, you have this Fi form. So here we are just describing a Calabi-Yau. So this is a Calabi-Yau cone. Then if you want to put type 2B, then and you put the D3 branch. So this is just a Calabi-Yau. We are not using string theory.
ADS 5 times S5, I have to turn on the 5-fold
filter. So you have F5, which is proportional to the volume form of the 5-fold. Opposed to n times the volume of x5. And then you have the dual part. So once you know the metric, you know exactly what is f. So the range of the parameter x and y is precisely, we have this cubic. So that the range of the parameter is precisely this. The, but from the first, the cubic is always in this way. From the first root to the second root, both for x and for y. So we see that if you just if we forget about this 3u1 fiber, we have we can find the we find the rectangle, and this is the where the x and y coordinates are defined. So forgetting about this u1 fiber is a standard thing you do in u1 in a toric geometry. So here we saw that we have these 3 u1s. That one can have, and in general, if you have a complex now, if you have a complex manifold which of dimension n, and you have a u1 to the n action, which is if you have the metric and you see that the metric does not depend on this u1 this n dimensional torus, then you say that the complex manifold is a toric manifold. And one can use more or less one wants to toric geometry is using this this fact that you have this u1 isometry. So for instance, in this case, we are left with we have a five dimensional. So let's see, let's go. If we have a cone, then we can. For instance, let me give a couple of examples. The simple example is S2. So if we have S2, then we can use this U1 isometry. And instead of writing, of drawing the full S2, we just draw a segment. This is the north pole and the south pole where the where the U1 fibers shrinks to zero size. Another example is we can have C. So C, the toric description of C is a half line. So we have this U1 fibers that shrink to zero size only in one point. Okay, then we can do, if you want P1, so this is CP1. This is the toric description of CP1, it's just a segment. If you want the toric description of P1 cross P1, which is the one relevant for the conifold, we get this diagram. So you just take this and multiply by itself. And if you want the toric description of CP2, we can do like this, for instance. We take C2. So let's start from CP1. We take C2. And then if we want to embed this P1 in CP2, this coordinates is just, let's take we have two. Omega 1 and omega 2 are two complex number. Here we plug omega 1 modulus square, omega 2 modulus square. So the if we can see P1 is embedded here as the equation omega 1 modulus square plus omega 2 modulus square is equal to 1. So we have, and then we quotient by U1 action. So this is the P1 inside the C2. And here, and instead we get the same result as before. So if you want CP2, we can do something like this. We take C3, which will be the octant. And then we impose the higher dimension analog of this, that will be a triangle. So the toric description of CP2 is a triangle. And so on. We can imagine more complicated stuff. So here we have a Calabi-Yau cone. So in general, the toric base of this Calabi-Yau cone will be for instance, this is one example. So it will be a three-dimensional cone, and one should think of a T3 fiber over here, that one of the S1 shrinks over the face and two over the lines and so on. But we can also, since we can forget, we can use this rescaling symmetry and forget about the radial direction. And so we have the Fereni-Calabi-Yau cone. We can give a description of this cone in terms of just the base. So for the conifold, we see that the base is a square. So this is the toric description of the conifold. This is everything we have to know. For the S5 or C3, with the toric description will be this thing. And these are can be considered as the toric diagram that were discussed last week, that can be obtained by the dimer using the adjacent symmetric of the dimer. So now let's see what can we learn from here, just without doing a global analysis. So one should do a global analysis and see what should be the range of the values alpha and beta in such a way that the metric is complete. But here we can use a shortcut, and we saw before that the range of the parameters is of x and y, which are the parameters on the base, is a rectangle. So there are four corner points. So what we know is that the toric diagram for these things will always be something like. So if one does the global analysis, one will find what is the precise value of alpha and beta in terms of some integers, for instance. And these are the integers that comes into the play, p, q, and r. So for instance, here we have these two real parameters cannot take arbitrary value, but they have to be some function of these three integers.
So, global analysis you're referring to is eliminating the conical singularity or at some point.
No, here we are looking at the five-dimensional base. So this is a compact manifold. We already forgot the conical. So we see that this will correspond to, we expect this to correspond to the more general toric diagram with the four corners, precisely four corners. So this, okay, let me do. This, for instance, is an example for more complicated things. And one can see that the more generic convex polygon with four corners instead depends using rescaling symmetry and change of variables on the plane, depends exactly on two real parameters. So our problem is to find, if you want to find the old quiver gauge theories for the LPQR, one is just to find the more general quiver gauge theory for corresponding to this toric diagram. This toric diagram can be thought as a very simple algebraic description of the singularity. It encodes all the information. One wants to understand all the information and go on to the quiver gauge theory.
So, Jay, I think it was too fast. What was the transition where you said that the number of external points is four? Based on what you saw in the geometry?
Because this is the range of these variables, x and y, which are the base, is given on is a rectangle.
By independent rectangles. By independent intervals. I'm saying the x and the y are an independent interval, so it's a product of intervals, right?
Yes.
That gives rise to a four external
points. Yes.
What would be the form of F?
For
5 and 6 external points?
No. Now, one can write down a metric which is a Kähler, but is not Einstein, also for the most general, with 5, 6 external points. But then you have some new thing to add that you don't know in order to get an Einstein metric.
All possible four-sided polygons are not inequivalent, though, correct? What's the? How do you know which ones are related to other ones by, like, what's the symmetry on the actual toric diagrams?
So the toric diagrams are defined on integer lattice. So the symmetry that you are left with is SL2D. So these are the transformation on the, which integer numbers that have.
Well, maybe also translations, right?
And yes, and times the square. Maybe.
Is there okay. also a discrete condition as well?
Yeah, that's what the SL2 is. That's a Z, not an R, right?
The
yeah. No, no, the other one. So the other one is.
Oh, you say the rotation is
a rotation.
Okay. And okay, if you forget about the discrete, we see that we can always. We can always take the origin to be here. Then we do a rotation, and then we do some rescaling. And then we see that we can put these 3 points can go wherever we want, and these 4 points will have a position, and this position will correspond to this alpha and beta.
So there's one thing that bothers me about this picture, and that is that the U1 eta isometry doesn't integrate for a full U1. It's only an R, right? I mean, it does not have closed leaves. So we can't actually take the quotient by the U1 to get the toric variety. These metrics.
Well, okay, this depends on what you put. If you use this sigma, I think you can. So this eta will be periodically identified. But this will not be the one which is dual to the R, U1R in the 4-dimensional. So if you want so you have a 3 torus, so you have 3 periodically identified coordinates. And this will be, okay, so in this picture, I think, phi as a period 2 pi, psi as period 2 pi, and eta as some period that you have to compute, but it is periodically identified. But this eta is not the one which is related to the R symmetry. The one related to the R charge is a particular combination of eta, psi,
so these are
and phi, actions. And this will not be closed.
You want actions, but they're not isometries of this metric.
They are isometries.
The point is that the metric wouldn't be like that. The norm of the, I mean, what you said is true, but you've changed the norm.
Okay.
So the metric wouldn't be that right. You'd have a function outside the front of that one squared.
I see.
I mean, so you take it like this. Take some.
He's done the general form for these terms, but not for that term. Right.
Yeah. It's some linear combination.
Okay. Yeah.
And the function in form depends on which coordinates?
Yeah, which one you use. Mm. So that particular one is not U1. That was the next point. But you just take another linear combination, recomplete the square, and you can divide it.
I'm a little confused about something you just said. After the symmetry, you said you can put 3 points in fixed places and then just derive it forth. To wherever. But doesn't that give a 2-integer parameterization of the metrics, and the LPQR seems to depend on 3, so...
No, okay, this is forgetting the SL2D. If you want the SL2D, you get something like this. You can put these two, you can pick a... if you just use the SL2D, you can put this to be 0, 0, this to be 1, 0, and these two will be free. But then you can still have you can still do some one something, and so we have 3, and this, but now they will be integers. So we have 4 integers minus 1.
There might be no side of length 1.
The length is not invariant at the SL2D.
Yeah, but
there's
something like if you have 2 relatively prime integers here.
Relatively prime, right? So how do you know that you have?
You can map them to one.
Those will be orbifolds, you mean?
So I don't understand. What is the question?
So if the lattice spanned by the 4 corners is not the full lattice, then you can't move it to the origin.
Yes, this is true. Yes. Okay.
So that's the third integer invariant. Or
no. Suppose you have a good. A good toric polygon. I mean, this is a 4 corners, and this for this you can well, okay, this you could just pick this, but you can do this if you don't have points on the internal points on the edges. If you have, for instance, one simple example is this. You take something like this.
That's
Then they're not.
So if you take this toric diagram, you cannot do all of that.
And
because
it's not isolated, actually. So that's.
But this, this is not, okay.
What do you mean by isolated?
The corresponding singularity in algebraic geometry is not isolated.
I see, yeah. And then for this, you can just apply the ordinary things for all the points.
That's right. It should be an orbital fold of some other case. That's right.
Yeah. Yes, this is an orbital. You could do something like this. This will not be an orbifold, but we will still have some orbifold singularity. This will be a singular five-dimensional. There will be orbifold singularity on the five-dimensional metric. Okay, so instead of doing the most general thing, which has been done for the LPQR, maybe we can just try to do the one, try to rederive the gauge theories for the YPQ quivers. So the for the one thing is the following: if you take this the toric. The toric diagram for T11, you get parallel external edges. So this will be parallel, this two will be parallel. And this is an SCL2Z invariant statement. So let's forget a little bit about the toric diagram and let's go to the really to the toric cone, and this will be the cut of the cone. If I change this in this way, in such a way that two are still parallel, then I will break one SU2 symmetry to be just U1, but I will keep some SU2 symmetry. If I change both, I will break both the SU2 symmetry. And so I'll go to the LPQR. If I do something like this, I will stay in the YPQ case, which has the YPQ have SU2.
So Sergio, you have a way of preventing the SU2 symmetries to the same diagram?
This is not the toric diagram. This is the base. This is, if you want, you should think something like this. This is really the toric cone where you have this U1 cube vibration. So if two are parallel, so we have four faces. If two faces are parallel, then will be the YPQ. If not, they will be LPQR. But this is not the. This is not the toric diagram. Then I have to take the dual.
You could take it as a condition for having
SU2 symmetry. Yeah.
What for five faces?
You cannot have SU2.
Is this real?
Well. Yeah, if you have an SU2 cross U1 cross U1, then you can quotient by the SU2 and the U1, and the U1 you are left with the segment, so you are just, the YPQ should be the more general.
There's a three toric diagram, which is five-sided, right? Or not, two, I'm sorry. Or the one.
Yeah, but this is not the toric diagram. The toric diagram for the YPQ is not, does not have any parallel edges.
There would be two faces that would be parallel in the sense that you said.
But this is the toric diagram.
But well, Jerome was questioning the statement whether SC2 symmetry can be extended to cases with more legs. But you seem to be saying that it's clear that for 5 and 6 legs there is SC2. Do you have any understanding?
So I think this is not a proof, but I think you can quotient by the SU2 and take away an S2. Then you can quotient by the 2U1 and take away the other two, and so you're left with just a segment. This will be the YPQ. This is all the homogeneity one, I don't know. Okay. So, okay, if you do something like this, you take the most general toric cone in integer we take the toric cone and we take it to be in an integer three-dimensional lattice, and then we take the dual and we can find the toric diagram. The toric diagrams, so now I can erase this. The toric diagrams for the YPQ are at the end is something like this. So this can be, if you compute the dual to this cone, you will find something which has two parallel external edges, two parallel faces. And okay, then we can also write down the relation. This 8 is P, and this 8 is Q. So now the problem is to find a quiver which is whose dual whose the moduli space of Aqua is described by this toric manifold. Now since it's already 3, I have to be. So this is not there is not a straightforward way to do that, and in this case for the LPQR this is pretty difficult. For the YPQ it can be done using the fact that we know that there is this SU2 symmetry. So let's study these two extremal cases, YP0 and YPP. So YP0 is a diagram, toric diagram is something like this. So this, for instance, is Y40. So this toric diagram is the toric diagram of the conifold with an orbifold. So we start with the toric diagram of the conifold. And then we take the four orbifolds along. So taking an orbifold in this language, taking a Zn orbifold in this language is just taking a refinement of the lattice. So for instance, we can refine along this direction, and we would get, if you take a V2 orbifold, then you will get something like this. So the toric diagram at the end will be something like this. But this is not what we want something different. So what we do is to take a refinement along this direction. So for instance, this is the V4, this is conifold, divided by Z4, and we know that this division is has to lie, this orbifold has to lie inside one of the SU2 because there is an SU2 cross SU2 for the conifold. Doing this orbifold, we are breaking just one, because we know this is the toric diagram of an SU2 invariant object. So now we would like to know what is the gauge theory corresponding to this thing. So there is a nice way, a simple way to do this using the. So for, in general, for orbifold, there is a strategy to, once you know the theory, to find the orbifold theory, which is group theory. But for the abelian orbifold, which takes toric object into toric object, because it doesn't break the U1 isometry, there is a simple way using the dimers we heard last week. So we can write, I don't know, how much time do I have?
Let's say until 10, and then we have some 5 minutes for discussions.
Okay.
So we have, let's say 7, 8 minutes.
Okay, so let's, so we can take this. So this is a fundamental domain we saw for the conifold. This is the one we saw before. And we can, taking an orbifold is just enlarging the fundamental domain. So here we can enlarge the fundamental domain in two ways. One way would be this, in this direction, and we would get here we are doubling the fundamental domain, and we would get this toric diagram. But if we enlarge the fundamental domain in this direction, then we would get this toric diagram. Then, so let's do it for the D3 orbifold. So now we have already defined the gauge theory, but let's write the standard quiver for this gauge theory. So we just have to take this fundamental domain and redraw it. So we have 6 nodes. These are the 6 nodes. So we can look at this node. For this node, we have one arrow that goes in this direction and one that goes from here. But this is precisely this arrow. So there are 2 arrows connecting these 2 nodes, and they go in the same direction. The same is true here. So we have this outgoing, this left going arrows is this arrow. So we can do like this. The same here. Then we have from here we have an arrow which is going up and goes back here. So from here we are going here. No. And from here we are going down and go back here. So. And so on. So we can do the last one is from this one. There is one going down that goes here and takes back this. So we can redraw this quiver. So this is just a way of redrawing this quiver. And one can redraw this quiver in this way. So there are six nodes. We've written them as an hexagon. So we have okay, so this is the quiver for Y. So this is the quiver for Y30, and from let's erase this. So we can do, for instance, the quiver for Y33. So Y33 will be this. Let's draw Y40. So this is Y44. So this is a triangular object. So this is an orbifold of CP2. So this is always a triangle. All triangular toric diagrams are orbifold of CP2. You want to know what is the gauge theory? We can do something like this. And maybe since it's late, I just do. So here we start from hexagonal dimer we saw last week. Then we dualize it. Dualizing an hexagonal dimer, one gets a triangular tiling. So something like. And so on. And the one can take the fundamental domain, enlarge it. And let me just give the result since it's late. So let's do Y44. We have all these doublets that correspond, for instance, if you take a fundamental domain which is more or less in this way, we have one arrow going from here, one arrow going from here, which form doublets. And then we have singlets. So in this way, if we take the superpotential that comes from the rules we saw last week, we get the superpotential which is a C2 invariant. This is non-trivial, but one can do the computation. For instance, if this is vu alpha and this is vu beta and this is y. So this alpha means that it is a doublet of, that we have two arrows, we can take them as a doublet. We see that the superpotential terms is corresponds to closed loop in the quiver. So in this case we get u alpha, u beta, y, and this epsilon alpha beta. And then we have another term for this other triangle, another term for this other. So in this case we have eight triangles, we have eight terms like this. Instead for the, and this is Y4-4.
I can't do that. So W is epsilon alpha beta U alpha V beta. What's the Y there?
This is this singlet field. So you, one here should put a trace. This is a trace in order to be gauge invariant. So instead for Y44, we add this other thing. Let's say it's something like that, but let me... Y40, we have... And here the superpotential term under the form, let's say this is U alpha, U tilde alpha, this is V, this is Y, is U alpha D.
Sorry, what case are you doing now?
This is Y40. This is always doing orbit folds. So we start from the no, for the, from the known things, which are N equal 4 and T11, and we do the orbit folds in order to get the two extremal cases. Then we try to guess what is the intermediate case. Here we always have epsilon alpha beta plus other things. So here the superpotential terms are always quartic, and this is because the original T11 theory has the quartic superpotential. Here the superpotential are always cubic because N equal 4 has cubic superpotential. So now we want to do the intermediate case, and here one can do a guess, but so the intermediate case we know from general arguments. So let's do Y41. This is Y41. So the number... So the area of the doing... So changing the values of Q, which is the second number here, the area of the toric diagram is not changing. This means that the number of gauge groups will remain the same. So here we have 8 gauge groups, here we have 8, and here we have 2 intermediate cases, where we'll always have 8 gauge groups. And we have to modify to find something in between these two cases, such a way that we always have SU2 invariance. So in order to have SU2 invariance, for instance, okay, from this would be Y43, and then we have another. We have to do a modification, and the only modification one can do is to erase one of these doublets. This will become a singlet. So this, if this becomes a singlet, this has to enter in a quartic term, because in any SU2 invariant term there have to be two doublets. So this will go in a quartic term with this, and in order to have a closed loop, we have to add another object here. So one can try something like that. So this is a modification, this is a guess of how to modify this to go in order to go from Y44 to Y43. And if this, now it's clear, one can apply this modification in this place, or one can apply it in another place. For instance, one wants Y41 would get something like 3 modification and 2 nodes. So this will be something like that. And it turns out that if you take these theories, which are the only one you can do in order to preserve this SU2 global symmetry, you get precisely the quiver gauge theories corresponding to this YPQ. And for instance, you can do various checks. I will not have time, but one thing you can do, you can apply a maximization to get the R charges of all the fields here. So you can also compute a central charge, which corresponds to the two-point function of energy momentum tensor. And you will get something which is related to the volume of the full five-dimensional manifold. This is known to be the case for a generic thing like this. And you can compare the volumes. The volumes will be rational numbers, depending on P and Q. The two computations will give the same result. Another thing you can do this Kalsterine matrix computation, and you will find from these quivers, once you write them down in a periodic fashion, you will find precisely this toric diagrams. Another thing, you can compare directly the R charges of the fundamental fields with the dimension of, with the volumes of supersymmetric free cycles. And also you can do some more complicated thing on this, on always related to the BPS sector, basically. And there is also a generalization to Del PQR, but this is much, this here is already a little bit complicated. Del PQR is more complicated, but this can be done, and these two checks has been done also for Del PQR.
So why did you have to guess? You know, does it follow from the new understanding of the Dymer program? So, did you have to guess because you didn't know the general rule coming from them?
Well, from the Dymer, you have a general rule once you have the quiver to get the toric diagram. But to do the opposite, you don't have a general rule. Still, I mean, this can help you. For instance, for the LPQR, the Dymer were useful in order to, in a sense, to guess the quiver. Without the dimer, you wouldn't be able to guess the PQR along this way, because here you use the SU2 global symmetry. For the PQR, you don't have, here you have only U1 to the cube isometries.
The one diagram you left out there, the Y42, one thing I've always been looking at is there are two separate ways to get from the Y43 to the Y42. So there are two different things you can draw from the Y42, one where the two crossing lines are parallel and one where they're perpendicular. Those things are supposed to be cyber dual or
yes.
Some way. How do you see that? How do you see that it doesn't matter which one you choose?
Well, if you want, you can apply the standard rules of cyber duality. For instance, you can apply cyber duality here. So this is a node with NF is equal to 2NC, because there are two incoming and two outgoing arrows. So if you dualize it, you will find NC prime is equal to NF minus NC is equal to NC. So you will find another phase of another quiver gauge theories where we have all SUN gauge groups. This is related to the fact that the geometries are toric. And if you do this, you apply the standard rule, you are moving this thing from here to here. So for instance, if you do this for the Y42, you have one here, you do a cyber duality here, you move this here. So this, you see that they are the same thing because of cyber duality. You can just apply the usual rule of cyber duality for that node.
So have you looked at the spectrum of divariants and things like that you can make in these models?
Yes. Yeah.
They should be transforming under some kind of symmetry group, right?
Sorry?
They should be transforming under some kind of symmetry group, some non-abelian group.
In this case, yes.
Do you know what these
why is non-abelian?
Well, I mean, already for S5 orbifolds, you get non-abelian symmetry groups that the divariants transform in representations of non-abelian symmetry groups.
So in this case you have let's call this field Z, this field Y.
I'm thinking of a paper of Luca, Brangamani, and Witten where they looked at ADS5 times S5 mod Z3.
Okay, this is because
pointed out that there's a bunch of divariants there which transform in the Heisenberg extension of Z3 times Z3. That's the kind of non-abelian symmetry group I'm talking.
Oh, discrete.
What?
Discrete symmetry groups. Yeah.
So what is the Heisenberg extension?
There is a unique Heisenberg extension.
Only delta 27?
It's a 27 dimensional group. Yes, it's a non-abelian 27.
Order
27. Excuse me. Order 27.
Well, in this case, you can see that you have the SU2.
I don't know, but I feel that there's some elaborate discrete group under which your baryons should transform. And that's related to my other question, which is, what do you know about the topology of these YPQs and LPQRs? First of all, are they even non-singular? I'm confused by what you said. Are they singular or non-singular?
Okay, so we are talking about the five-dimensional Sasaki-Einstein metric.
Yes.
Okay, so for the YPQ, they are, so in these cases, YPP and Y, for YPQ, if P and Q is a non-trivial common divisor, then there will be orbifold singularities.
Okay.
So, for instance, this case is singular. There is an orbifold singularity. Sorry. Y4Z is singular.
Okay.
Y for one is not singular. Y for four is singular. But this is not, it's just an orbital singularity because the curvature is constant since an Einstein orbit.
The topology has two crosses three.
Then, if they are non-singular, the topology is S2 crosses three because you have four external. It's like, it's the same of the topology of the conifold. Because you are more or less you are.
So if P and Q are relatively prime, you say it's just S2 times S3?
It's always S2 times S3. And this is the same also for the LPQR if there is if they are non-singular. For the LPQR, there are some singular examples where the topology is not S2 times S3. For instance, you can take this toric diagram. This was a gauge theory. This is gauge theory where the gauge theory here was studied a long time ago. And here we see that there is a point on the edge. This corresponds to the fact that there is a singular there is a singularity. And here you have the topology. If you the topology should be S2 times S3. Okay. Times S2 times S3. So here we have you should have two non-trivial two cycles. In the other case, it's like in the conifold where you have one. And here you can refine it and go on and add more complex things. So these always have four corners, but they have some integer points on the edges. And so this is the singular, but changes also the topology. And for the d-baryons, in general, you can construct the d-baryonic operators just looking at the. You take the term, for instance, you take z, then you take epsilon, with this epsilon. Then you put a lot n z,
yeah.
Then you take another epsilon, which is the determinant of z. And here, for instance, you have four different objects like that. So maybe here you should look at the non-abelian.
Fit together into a representation of
the. Yeah, this has not been studied.
Abelian discrete group.
Maybe it's a symmetric group of this
quiver.
That would be pleasant.
No, there shouldn't be a discrete group of the quiver. One other thing is that there is a continuous SU2, so if you take the determinant of U, let's take the U, here you can put some U1, and then you can put U2. So here you can decide how many U1 and how many U2, and this is a non-abelian group. This is the SU2 that acts on the. But indeed, these d-baryons correspond to, in the geometry, you have a round two sphere, you fix a point in the round two sphere. Then you will have a three-dimensional manifold remaining. This is BPS, and you can move this point on the round two sphere, and this corresponds to put how many ones you put and how many two.
So you're really sure it's S2 times S3 and not some lens space or something like that?
Then you can take orbifold if you want, and then you can have a more complicated geometry.
That's what you get for. We're getting late. Did you want to ask a question? Let's stop.